listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, I got the email, I believe it was yesterday. No, it must have been Sunday afternoon because it happened Saturday night. Libertarian capitalism killed one of my best friends. Libertarian capitalism also killed my father and the family of one of my coworkers. Let me explain. There are two ways that a nation can allow products to come into the marketplace. The libertarian, unregulated American way and the regulated capitalism European way. When a nation like the United States uses the libertarian way to bring goods to the marketplace, it lets corporations send whatever they damn well please into the marketplace, regardless of how dangerous it might be. The theory is that once people notice how deadly something is, they'll stop buying it, and the free market will magically correct itself. Nations that use the regulated European way, however, force manufacturers to prove that products are safe to use before they're made available to purchase. This is called the precautionary principle. It requires manufacturers to prove to government, and thus to society, us, that the new product is safe before it's let into the marketplace. Here's how this country's libertarian approach to regulation killed my best friends, my father, and the family of one of my coworkers. Scientists and health experts knew as far back as 100 years ago that asbestos caused a god-awful form of lung cancer called mesothelioma or mesothelioma. But because America does not use the precautionary principle, toxic asbestos was used in our homes, our workplaces, even our schools well into the 1970s. My friend Terry O'Connor, my friend Rob Witorski, my dad all died of mesothelioma. My coworker Heidi Tauber's life was torn apart by her parents' fight with the disease, and I believe that this pain led directly to her death 2 years ago. Consider these human stories. Back when Terry and I earned and owned an herbal tea factory, it was back in the 70s, neither one of us wanted to mow the lawn. We had this big old house we were renting. And the city hit us with a big fine for having a lawn that was like, you know, an eyesore. Now, Terry was an artist, and I was a rebel. I guess Terry was, too. So instead of paying the fine, Terry designed some really elaborate labels for every weed in the front yard with their Latin names. And, you know, fully designed artwork. We put them on wooden stakes. We filled out the appropriate paperwork, and we had our front lawn designated as a botanical garden. Got us out of the big fine. I mean, we could have mowed the lawn in 15 minutes, right? But setting up a botanical garden, it took weeks of what are now very wonderful memories, frankly. But years earlier, at the motor wheel factory where Terry worked for about a year before going to college, Terry was going through 1 to 3 pairs of asbestos gloves a day, along with his other factory workers. He had to use those gloves to remove burning hot steel wheel parts from a giant press that was 3 stories tall. The line went really fast, and it was dreadful work. I talked to Terry over the past few months, almost every weekend by Skype. His oxygen tube was the least of his discomforts, while chemo was flowing through his veins, adding a few more weeks, maybe a month or so, to his life. Terry was a special guy, and America would be a better place if Terry, and the world, I think, would be a better place if Terry had been on this planet for another 10 or 20 years. I know I would be better if he was still here. His wife, his children, his grandchildren would be. Another story. My dad, Carl Hartman, loved books, loved history. After spending 2 years in the Army during World War II, he was hoping to graduate from college and teach history. That's where I got it, right? In fact, he wanted to do it at the university level. He wanted to teach at the university level. If he could just hang on to the GI Bill and he had a day job in a camera store, if he could just do that long enough to get a PhD. Started college in 1948, and in 1950, he'd been married for just a few months when the surprise came that forced him to drop out of college. His wife was pregnant with their first child. That would be my mom, and that first child was me. This was a time when husbands worked, wives tended the home, and being a good father and provider was one of the highest callings to which a man could aspire. So my dad dropped out of school, kept his day job from 9 to 5 at the camera shop, got a second job at a metal fabricating plant in Grand Rapids, working with molten hot metal from 7 p.m. to 4 a.m. He was exposed to toxic asbestos for, well, most of that grueling shift. For much of my mom's pregnancy and my first year, my dad slept 3 hours a night and caught up on weekends. In the process, he earned enough to get an apartment, cover the cost of starting a family, and over the next 45 years, he continued to work in the steel and machine industry. In later years, he worked as a bookkeeper and manager for Michigan Tool and Die Company, as my three younger brothers were born. In 2006, my dad injured himself tripping on the stairs and ended up in the hospital with a compression fracture of his spine. He had thought that that was causing all the pain he was having in his abdomen. The doctors discovered, though, that his lungs were filled with mesothelioma. Doctor told him he had 6 months to live, and he died with me sitting next to him. He died in excruciating pain, all because he wanted to do right by his family. Heidi Tauber, my co-host on KPOJ Radio back in Portland when I was doing the morning show there, she grew up in Libby, Montana. Her dad was a police officer. Her mom worked around the asbestos mines. Asbestos mining was a principal business for that town. The air was filled with asbestos dust. Both of Heidi's parents died from mesothelioma, as did many of the citizens of Libby. Heidi was wounded by that, by them dying, as well as the death of much of her extended family, and many of her childhood friends died from mesothelioma. In my opinion, her death a few years ago was partly caused by those wounds. Rob Witorski, one of our employees at the tea factory, one day when he was putting bags of extra white packaging peanuts, you know, the shipping peanuts, up in the attic. I mean, we got these things in these giant bags of four feet across, you know, and they bring a semi-truck. We'd get like, you know, 100 bags of it, filled the attic with them. Louise showed up with our oldest daughter, who was 2 years old at the time. And our daughter asked Rob where the bags, you know, what was in the bags. He and Terry told her that this is where the snow gets stored for the winter. And she was so amazed. She was walking around for months telling everybody about how we were the keepers of the snow. Before Rob worked for us at the tea factory, he had also worked in the auto industry and was exposed to asbestos, just like Terry and just like my dad. All of these people were technically killed by asbestos, but they were really killed by the unregulated libertarian capitalism that allowed big corporations to put asbestos into the marketplace, even though they knew it killed people. Deregulated, or our laissez-faire libertarian unregulated capitalism, is what really killed my friends and my dad. We've now outlawed asbestos in the United States, but today, right now, there are more than 80,000 chemicals in our environment that we haven't even begun to test to find out how toxic or deadly they may be, and we're just beginning to look at the GMOs. Europe and Japan use the precautionary principle. They require you prove something safe before you put it in the marketplace, but our country is still one big libertarian experiment. And with exploding autism and cancer rates, we're probably going to find out in the next generation what's here right now that people are going to be looking back on in 30 years and saying, oh yeah, just like asbestos. We need to seriously reconsider unregulated libertarian capitalism and think about the safety of people, everyday people, as a higher priority than the profits of hustlers and giant corporations. The planet would be a hell of a lot better place if these people had lived out their natural lives. So goodbye and Godspeed, Terry, Dad, Heidi, and Rob. I'm going to miss y'all. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Summer, by the way. Give us a shout if there's anything on your mind. I've got some very interesting news here for you. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our electric grid is falling apart. We're going to debate Tony Stiles about that in the next hour. He's going to tell us how we should leave it all to the corporations. They will come up with a solution.
Right.
And Tim Kavanaugh with the Daily Caller is going to be here for our in our third hour to talk about Google telling us that privacy? You expected your emails were private? Really? Ah! I'm going to say, you know, actually, I think that the post office should start doing this. In fact, let me lay out the argument. This is very simple. The argument why I think the post office should be offering secure, encrypted email service. Right now, if I send a letter through the mail, whether it's to Shano in the next room, well, actually, yeah, if I drop it in a mailbox and you get it 2 days later or a day later, whatever, whether it's to Shano or whether it is to one of my kids on the West Coast, if anybody opens that letter without a warrant, without Fourth Amendment due process, if they open that letter without a warrant, they have committed a federal crime. So the infrastructure is already there for the post office to deliver our mail in a way that is secure, that is protected by law. Now, if a company comes along and says, yeah, we will provide you with secure private email, encrypted, secure, HTTPS, you know, all that kind of stuff. You get a PGP password, you know, pretty good privacy, you know, some sort of encryption code, a key and a decode key for the other end and all this kind of stuff. So a company comes along and says that if you find out that they've lied to you or whatever, the most you can do is go to court and sue them. Or if somebody in their organization takes your email, decrypts it, and sells it to the National Enquirer, the most you can do is go to court and sue them because it's a corporation. You have a contract with them. It would be breach of contract. You can't throw them in jail. You can't throw in jail their employees. You can't throw into jail anybody who reads your email. I mean, you just, you know, there's no legal remedy, really, because there's no law against it. It's just failure to maintain a contract. Also, if that company goes out of business, the contract becomes null and void, and the company can then sell your information, including all your emails, if they choose to. Or the, what's left of the company. So, as long as there's a corporation involved, there's really no presumption or way to enforce genuine privacy of email. Now comes the post office. Congress has the authority, unlike Google. Google does not have the authority to write a contract that says that if somebody reads your mail, they go to jail. Congress does have that power. The power to put somebody in jail is something reserved to the government. So Congress could say, you know, the post office is going to offer a new secure email service, and it's going to work just like the postal first-class mail service, in as much as you write your email, you drop it into a secure, encrypted envelope. You email it. And the person on the other end has a secure key to open that envelope, a letter opener, a digital letter opener that opens that envelope, and they can read it. And if anybody in between, without a warrant, opens that email, they've broken the law. They've committed a federal crime. You with me on this? Not only that, and you say, well, I don't want the government handling my email. The NSA will read it. Well, they can do that with Google Mail, too. One. And two, if you pass a law that says, you know, the NSA has to have a warrant, too, that's the law. The NSA would be breaking the law if they violated that. And perhaps most importantly, you know, when Google, and I don't mean to single out Google. This is true of AOL. It's true of, you know, any mail carrier, email carrier that you have, just, you know, right across the board, when they are handling and delivering your email, the contract that defines the terms by which they handle it and how much of it they can read and how deeply they can read into it to decide which ad they're going to deliver to you and all this other nonsense, that contract is not written with you as one of the participants in the room. You're not in the room when that contract is written. That contract is written between Google or AOL or fill in the blank, Hotmail, whatever, you know, MSM or Microsoft. It's written between them and their corporate lawyers. They decide what the contract is that you agree to when you click, yes, I agree to the terms and conditions. If the post office is delivering these things as a government or quasi-government agency, and I think they should be fully nationalized again, that contract, those terms of delivery, that contract is written with you in the room. It's written by your elected representatives. You have a say in it. If you don't like it, you can bounce those people out of office and replace them with people who will make it how you do like. It has to be published as a part of the federal law. You can read the contract. Legislators can modify the contract in response to public opinion. It's not done for the profit of shareholders. It's done for the benefit of the public. So doesn't it make sense? And this is part of Bernie Sanders' bill, by the way. I'm quite certain. We should ask him about it a week from Friday. But I'm quite certain that part of Bernie's proposal is this Senate bill that he has submitted is to let the post office get into the electronic mail business. And it makes so much sense to me for the reasons I just laid out. So anyhow, a couple things on the table to discuss for the day, along with the other news of the day. 10th anniversary of the massive blackout in the Northeast. And my farewells to my friend Terry O'Connor, who died Saturday night.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll be picking up your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. From the Weapons of Mass Deception, Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, just a thought occurred to me. There's a headline in today's New York Times, which, by the way, is back up. They were down for about an hour. It says that they were down because they had a scheduled maintenance thing that blew up in their face. Who knows? But in any case, recess on Capitol Hill. How should lawmakers connect with constituents in the age of email? Is a full month break still needed? Actually, Congress is taking 5 weeks off. And the reason that they're doing this, the reason Congress takes the whole summer off, I mean, if you go back 100 years, it's because America was largely an agricultural country, and a lot of people, members of Congress, are farmers, and they had to go home and bring in the crops. I mean, pretty much everything, you know, came to a halt during the summer when the crops needed to be brought in. It's why this is why we have summer breaks in school, because the kids used to have to go home and help bring in the crops. Now... Oh, and then, you know, from the 1930s with unionization largely in the auto industry, but as it spread across the country, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and the 80s until Reagan, you know, got his hands around the throats of organized labor. Average working people in America had at least a week every summer off, and typically two. My dad used to get 2 weeks of vacation every year. Some people got three. And some people, if they'd been working at the job long enough, got even 4 weeks of vacation. This was not all that uncommon back prior to 1980, when the unions were king and the job market was fairly tight. So since the citizens were taking time off during the summer, Congress took time off during the summer. But, you know, since the Reagan Revolution, people aren't taking time off during the summer anymore. And, you know, if you're not taking time off, should Congress be? I mean, I think this is like, it's an anachronism, you know? It's sort of like the Electoral College. There's stuff that needs to get done right now. There are people who are hurting. They need a job. They need unemployment benefits. They need housing. They need to get the damn banksters off their back. Congress should not be taking a five-week vacation. Period. Mark in Lyons, Illinois. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Yes, Tom. I hope you're doing great, and I hope you even do better.
I am, and I will. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Tom, yeah, I don't mean to start so such a glib start when I heard such a heartfelt testimonial about the effects of asbestos earlier from you. But, you know, one of the sad stories about asbestos is that, you know, there was a company called Dresser that was heavily invested or even privately owned by the Bush family. And they were facing about $100 billion in liability from the asbestos lawsuits that were facing them coming up in the 90s. They were purchased by Halliburton. And it just about broke Halliburton. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I do. I know that Halliburton was on the verge of bankruptcy when Dick Cheney became vice president. And it was only the government contracts, the no-bid government contracts that he got for them that went along with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that saved
really
that company.
Bailed out by the wars in Iraq.
I did not realize that the Bush family, though, had any involvement in Dresser Industries at all. Did they really?
Yeah, no, it was almost exclusively owned by the Bush family.
So the Bush family sold it to the Cheney family business.
No, Halliburton bailed out Dresser.
Yeah, and so the Bush family had Dresser Industries, which was hemorrhaging or had the potential to hemorrhage money because of the asbestos liabilities. They sell this to Dick Cheney and Halliburton, which he was the CEO of. Halliburton now is going bankrupt. The Bush family is doing just fine.
And do you know? Then the Iraq War comes along. How convenient.
Yeah. Well, the Afghanistan War first, but both of them were money pots for, wow, amazing. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know about the Bush family, but Shane's nodding his head and, you know, yes. Say what? It's online. Yeah, okay. This is not a secret, apparently. Mark, thank you for that. Thanks for sharing that information. Wayne in Granby, Mass. Hey, Wayne, thanks for listening to WHMP. What's up?
Hi, Tom. A couple of things. Number one, I used to live in central New Jersey. I'm sure you've heard of Johns Manville.
Oh, yeah. Another asbestos.
Running their big corporation in Manville. They say in Manville it used to snow asbestos.
Yeah.
People were dying of white lung like it was, you know, an everyday thing.
Yep.
The other thing I wanted to ask was, what do you think of the possibility of trying to reestablish something like the CCC? My dad had been a member during the Depression, and I'm thinking of the wildfires in the West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we had people clearing out the brush and dead leaves and branches and everything else, wouldn't those fires be a whole lot easier to control?
Yeah, they would, and the forests would be a lot healthier if they just did selective forestry. If they went through and they pulled out the you know, when the entire forest reaches like kind of medium size, then it just starts getting taller and taller. The trees get spindly. You know, in a natural forest, you've got trees that are actually a little shorter, but they, you know, one individual tree, hardwoods anyway, might, you know, cover a half an acre, a quarter of an acre. I mean, a large area. And you get these giant old trees. But, you know, a forest, it takes a long time for a forest to get to that point. I mean, hundreds of years, many centuries. But you can move a forest in that direction. Louise and I used to own 400 acres up in Vermont, and we actually hired a guy with a team of horses who came in and selectively logged that. And it wasn't for the purposes of selling the lumber, although the selling of the lumber paid for his services, but it was to open up areas around hardwood trees, you know, take out the softwoods around some of the hardwoods and give them space to grow horizontally to make that forest more healthy. And a healthy forest doesn't burn as quickly as an unhealthy forest. And so that's something that could be done. And I mean, yeah, there's a lot of things that could be done. But, yeah, we need a new CCC.
Along with putting people back to work.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, I know Republicans won't like that.
Well, no, the Republicans hate that. They want the economy to absolutely suck as long as there's a Democrat in the White House. And then the minute a Republican gets in the White House, they're going to be just like they were under Bush and the Bush before him and Reagan. Oh, let's spend some money. You know, they'll be off to the races. So, Wayne, thanks for the call. Excellent suggestion. Karen in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Karen. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Karen.
I wanted to give you the human side of this problem with the asbestos, because this is not a problem that has gone away.
My best friend died this weekend.
Yeah. Well, my father worked in air conditioning and heating throughout my childhood, and at 38, he got sick and died. And it said on his death certificate that he had asbestosis, because this was before everything came out.
Right.
And so, of course, the statute of limitations had run out by the time everything was exposed.
Right.
Well, at the age of 51, my brother got really ill, and they found that he had cancer all through his body. Well, he worked with my father when he was a teenager,
right,
installing air conditioning and heating in these attics with this asbestos.
Yep.
Now my oldest son, who is 43, has found out that he has lung cancer.
Oh, my.
But he didn't work in air conditioning and heating. He worked at one time when he was younger installing brakes on vehicles.
Yeah.
And they had to pound these old drums off of the cars.
Oh, I've done it.
And
I used to, you know, I was working at a gas station, you know, and I changed tires, but every now and then I'd have to change brake pads. Yeah.
Well, and they had to blow them out with an air hose.
That's
and
right.
So forth.
Yep.
So now we're dealing with my oldest son at 43, but my youngest son and my grandson had to live in low income housing,
which was filled with asbestos.
Yes, these houses, they can't sell them, so they're putting them into the program, the HUD program for low-income housing. They go in and paint, and they lived in this house that it was snowing from these ceiling tiles.
Oh, my.
Really old, old, old.
Yeah, those old asbestos ceiling tiles that were sold because they were fireproof.
It would cover everything in their little house.
Amazing.
So it was like a year and a half before they could afford to move from there.
Yeah.
So low-income people are living with this asbestos.
Yeah. And it's not just low-income people, and it's not just, you know, and yes, it's continuing. When I was a little kid, when I was 6, 7 years old, I used to walk after school over to Lansing Tool and Die Sinking where my dad worked. And the steel, and I'd spend a couple of hours there before 5 o'clock he got off work, and then he'd take me home. And the steel would come in these rolls of corrugated asbestos. It looked like, you know, corrugated cardboard, like paper box stuff, cardboard box stuff, but it was asbestos. And I would sit on the floor and unroll this stuff, and I used to just be fascinated by it. I'd pull out pieces of asbestos and I'd, you know, have them on my hand, and I'd be looking at them in these long, long asbestos crystals. I was just fascinated by it. When I was living in Germany in the 80s, I had what turned out to be a panic attack. I thought I was having a heart attack. They took me into the hospital. It was my first experience with the German healthcare system, which was just great. Bang, right into the hospital. Bang, right up to get a lung x-ray. The doctor sits down with me and says, your heart's fine, but he said, look at this in your lungs. And there was about a half a dozen, maybe a dozen little white spots. Looked like somebody had taken a pencil eraser and just put little white dots around. And I said, what's that? And he said, have you ever been exposed to asbestos? And I said, yeah, I have. And he said, well, those are apparently areas where you've formed scar tissue around it. He said, you need to keep an eye on those. So, you know, I'm still well as far as I know, but it's affecting a lot of people and will for a long, long time. Karen, thank you for the call, and I'm sorry to hear about the people in your family.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, but let us make the absolutely emphatic point. None of this would have happened if we'd had the precautionary principle instead of laissez-faire libertarian capitalism. You know that our national deficit is shrinking? It's like a third of what it was when Obama first came into office and George Bush handed him the keys. It's down by a third. Excuse me. It's about two-thirds of what it was. It has decreased. It has declined every single year that he's been president. Did you hear that on Fox News? Not so much. Right. Okay. Gee, what a surprise. Joe in Lake Elsinore, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I promised I said I was going to ask one question, and I had a comment, but now I have two. I hate watching your show and listening on the phone, but
it's okay. Anyway.
I just dropped off my third grader. I got to pick them up in a little bit, so they get summer has officially begun for us that are stuck at home. But
there you go.
Enjoyed it. At any rate, I was quite moved by your comments earlier about the asbestosis mesothelioma type situation. But I've been calling about, because I'm sure you're probably aware of the closure of San Onofre, and that's something that I think is a Californian. It's
the nuclear power plant in California,
a lot. Right? And I'm really glad to see it finally closed. I remember losing that part of my surfing area when I was a kid, but now they're sending a letter to the ratepayers saying that we're on the hook. And I mean, I think back to when they had Three Mile Island, and I was like, well, we mean the costs. 40 years ago, they destroyed the beach, and then there was an earthquake in the Pacific, and Japan suffered this catastrophic, and they're blaming it on some kind of an engineering snafu. But this is an indisposable waste, and they can't even ship to Utah, I guess, so they didn't approve that. I'm not sure how that happened, but we need to find clean and, you know, non-polluting, reliable, such as wind and solar, hydro and this ocean type of power source, I think, would be something that...
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. So your local power company wants you to pay for the cost of dismantling and deactivating San Onofre, is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
For decommissioning?
Yes, the regulatory compact with our Public Utilities Commission, and they've been doing it this way forever.
They will continue to, Joe. We pay for nuclear power before we get it. We pay while we get it. We pay after we get it. We pay. And who makes the money? Oh, and by the way, we provide the insurance for free through our tax dollars. And who makes the money? The fat cats in the energy industry. It's bizarre. Joe, thanks for the call. Well said. Carrie in Thomas, West Virginia. Hey, Carrie, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Glad to talk to you. My condolences on your recent losses and past losses.
Thank you.
But I'm calling more about the suggestion of the U.S. Postal Service taking over email, that it would provide any security. The thing I called about is a program called Carnivore, and this was noted by the group called EPIC, Electronic Privacy Information Center.
Right.
This was noted around 1999-2000, and it was under the auspices, I think, of the FBI. They required or were trying to require IPS providers, Internet Provider Services, at that time to basically scan not just where our email was going, but the content of those emails, trying to pick up keywords, trying to find out who they should maybe watch or what was going on, but this was applicable to all emails regardless of their source or where they were going. It's a program that has been in place prior to 9/11 and all of the new security stuff that's going on.
Right.
I would be interested to know if Bernie is aware of that, what he knows about Carnivore.
I think pretty much everybody, well, I don't want to say everybody knows about Carnivore, but Carnivore is not a secret. I mean, once it was revealed, it's been well discussed in the press. It's been several years, but it was well discussed in the press when it came out.
It has been several years, but it surprises me that people are reacting now with the idea that what, people are looking at my email?
Right.
It's, like you say.
How quickly we forget. Yeah, no, it's an excellent point. And Carrie, this makes my point of how if the post office handled this, we could write the rules and regulations in a way that are designed to provide maximum benefit and service to we the people rather than to provide maximum profit to a bunch of corporate shareholders, which is how Hotmail writes their terms and conditions, how Gmail writes their terms and conditions, how AOL mail, you know, and all the others. I think this is one more, even though Carnivore was a government operation, it was heavily privatized, but I still think this is, one more argument for the post office being in the email business. But right now they can't do it by law. Congress has to authorize them, which the Republicans do not want to have happen, because God forbid they should compete with some private corporation who can make a buck off your email. Carrie, thanks for the call. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Well, I don't think the post office is as secure as you think it is. I kind of remember back during the Bush administration, there was a little bit of a kerfuffle when the Bush administration asserted they had the right to open any letter they wanted to.
You're right.
And I don't remember any court telling them they were wrong.
You're right. And they were asserting that in a way that had the Obama administration been on their toes, or had they been willing to follow through on lawbreakers, I think that people could have been prosecuted for. And by the way, an end got put to it. Meanwhile, corporations are opening your email every single day and reading it so they can find out what kind of things you might buy so they can sell that information to corporate marketers, which is kind of a whole different thing. You know, your point is made, but I still think that the post office would do better. Scott in Deming, New Mexico. Scott, a minute to the end of the hour. It's yours.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Just wanted to share with you some of my thoughts concerning nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in coal-fired power plants for 28 years and retired recently, within the last 10 years. And if nukes, I know for a fact that nukes are operated just as much by public utilities, coal-fired, hydro, et cetera. And the safety issues that always came about in a continuous manner have been overlooked and will be overlooked on a constant basis. And that's frightened me more about nuclear power than anything else.
Oh, yeah. You can look on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's website, and you know, virtually every single day in America, there's some nuclear power plant somewhere in the United States that has some sort of mini emergency or sometimes a real emergency. They happen constantly. Leaks, emergencies, system failures, all kinds of stuff. It's just, you know, it's only the big ones that get anybody's attention. And even then, they don't get a whole lot of attention. Scott, thank you for pointing that out. Well said. It is 4 o'clock here on the East Coast, coming up on the top of the hour. We'll be back with Tony Stiles, and we're going to talk about, is it time for America to build a smart grid? You know, like Eisenhower, build a smart highway system.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And today is the 10th anniversary of the 2003 Northeast blackout. We're also seeing this incredible increase in the cost of dealing with power failures as a consequence of increasingly more severe storms, the consequence of global warming. Now our power failures are costing between $18 and $33 billion a year. And two, three times that sometimes, and when we have a year with a superstorm like Sandy, 70% of our nation's power lines and transformers are more than 25 years old. The 2009 stimulus put $4.5 billion into an electrical grid investment, but that's less than a quarter of what we should be doing in any one year. So, according to the Electrical Engineering Department of the University of Minnesota, we should invest $21 million every year for the next two decades just to get our electrical grid up to today's standards. So, well, anyhow, Tony Stiles is with us. He's the host of the Tony Stiles Show on Omaha, Nebraska's 1290 KOIL. Tony Stiles, STILES.com is his website. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us. One of the things we know about private for-profit corporations is that they're in business to make money. Back in the 1930s, it was not profitable to take electricity out to rural areas. Franklin Roosevelt tried to talk them into it. They said no. He begged them. They said no. So he created the Rural Electrification Administration in 1935. And by 1939, 288,000 households had electricity through 417 rural electric cooperatives, all of which were owned by the local rural communities. In the 1950s, same thing happened with telephone service. The phone company said, screw you, to Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president, when he said, why don't you take telephone service out to the rural areas? And so he created the Rural Telephony Administration. Isn't it time, given the sorry state of our electrical grid, to say, you know, it's time to revisit what Dwight Eisenhower, that great Republican president, did when he turned our 19th century horse and buggy road system into a modern 20th century interstate highway system? Only do
sure,
it for our
wonderful.
Electrical system.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question first. How much money does the United States have right now?
The United States is the richest nation in the world with a net worth of around $54 trillion.
Yeah, and our debt is how much to other countries?
What does it matter?
Well, if we don't have money, you don't spend it.
We have plenty of money. The United States has plenty of money. Our billionaires have plenty of money. Our working people have plenty. In fact, it's just some very simple formulas. In the 1950s, back when Eisenhower was building his highways, the corporate share of the federal receipts for income taxes was a third. They paid a third of the total into the federal government. Now it's 11%. Very, very simple math. Back in the 1950s when Eisenhower was doing this, the top income tax rate on people after they made $3 million was 91%. Now it's, if you're Mitt Romney, now it's 20%. So, you know, with some very simple tweaks, there's plenty of money out there.
Yeah, there's plenty of money out there. And this may surprise you about me. I understand that, you know, capitalism, it works. Socialism, it works. There's a lot of different methods out there that work. The problem is that you can't have one with a little bit of another. That's
all we've ever
lies.
Had, Tony.
Yes, and it's not
working. That's all we've ever had. No,
and it's not working.
It's not working. It's not working to the extent that Republicans and libertarians sabotage it. But back in the day before all of this Republican sabotage began with Reaganomics, we had a country that actually, you're probably not old enough to remember it, but before Ronald Reagan came along, local communities actually had local businesses. The economy was doing well. You could raise a family with the income of one wage earner. I mean, back before Reagan declared war on unions, back before the top income tax rate was dropped from 91% down to, or 74% down to 28%, the average CEO only took 30% or 30 times what his worker took, because to take any more than that was stupid. The tax rate was 74%. And as a result, workers were actually making good wages.
I understand that, but we're not in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s, or even 80s or 90s anymore. This is
no,
a new time.
No, I realize 32 years of Reaganomics has hollowed out this country. It's devastated the industrial base of this country.
I don't like Reaganomics. And I
so let's undo it. Let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Let's roll back the Reagan and Clinton trade policies and go back to the protectionist trade policies that from the George Washington administration to the Reagan administration built this country.
What will that cost us to do versus actually doing it?
That won't cost us anything.
If it doesn't cost us anything to do, then it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, what it's, you know who it's going to cost? It's going to cost the Koch brothers. I mean, who needs $50 billion, right? It's going to cost Mitt Romney. It's going to cost the guys who have over $1 trillion sitting in bank accounts overseas. It's going to cost them something. But you have to ask yourself, how much is enough?
For me, how much is enough?
How much is enough for a billionaire? Do you really need that extra billion?
Well, sure, of course. You have, like what they said on Wall Street, how many boats can you ski behind?
Exactly.
You don't need a whole lot.
Right. So
in this world. My house is paid off. So, my car's paid off. I'm a happy guy. I don't need any more. You know, if they didn't pay me for radio, I'd be happy with that.
Why not build a modern electric grid? It'll be the best thing that can be done for business. Every time this country has upgraded its infrastructure, whether it was the railroads in the Lincoln administration, or whether it was the highway system in the Eisenhower administration, or whether it was the electrical systems in the Roosevelt administration, every time we have massively upgraded our infrastructure, business has stepped in to make use of it.
Will business be able to do this without government help?
No. There's no business in America that could build a national smart grid.
Well, there you have it. Then don't do it. It's that simple.
No, there you have it. Government should do it. That's
government doesn't have the right to do anything. Government is there to do very little.
I would suggest you read Article 1 of the Constitution.
I understand that. The government is there to work for the people. And if they're going to build something in the people's name, if the people approve that, if it's something that everybody wants in each state as its own individual place, as its own individual place of experimentation, if that is something that's passed in those places, then, yeah, that's the people have made their voices heard, and that's okay. But the government shouldn't just jump into something without anybody giving them any approval.
The government is us, Tony. We give them approval in things called elections. If our elected officials were to say, okay, let's build a smart grid, and all of America was horrified, those people would stop that smart grid really fast because they realize that they're going to be bounced out of office.
A lot of people are horrified by Obamacare, and that's being pushed into everywhere.
That's because the majority of people are not horrified by Obamacare. The majority of people would rather the health insurance companies were no longer allowed to rip them off.
You can speak for every single state and for every single insurance company. You, Tom Hartman, can speak for those people.
I am not even attempting to speak for them. I can read surveys. I can read opinion polls. You ask people, even in the red states, they're refusing to expand Medicare so that Obamacare is available to people. Places like Alabama and Florida and Mississippi. You ask people in those states, the majority of Republicans will say, yes, this state should take that Medicare money. The partisans in those states are saying no because they're trying to blow up anything. They don't want the president. They don't want this Democratic president to have any successes. This is purely political, and you know it.
Yeah, of course. It's completely political, 100%. I'm with you on 100%. There should be a lot more agreement in Washington. Unfortunately, there's not, and that's when they stop representing people like me, people like you, people around America. They stop representing people
I would say they stopped representing us the night of the inauguration when 14 of them met in the caucus room restaurant and conspired to destroy this country.
That would be very accurate. You know, when they take people out of the equation, when they take Americans out of the equation, it's no longer our government. They've been doing that for far too long.
Paul Ryan, Greg Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Henseling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker got together and said, we are going to obstruct everything, and they've done it. So, anyway, Tony Stiles, Tony, TonyStiles.com is the website. You can listen to him on Omaha, Nebraska. It's 1290 KOIL. Thanks, Tony.
You betcha, brother.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Is it time to build a national smart grid? I'm not sure I ever figured out exactly what Tony's answer was, but I still say yes. Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. So, in the 1930s, 90% of city dwellers had electric power, but in rural areas, in the 1930s, only 10% of people had electric power. It took Franklin Roosevelt passing the Rural Electrification Administration, the law that funded, you know, where he said, okay, Thomas Edison's company is not going to take electricity out into the boondocks, I will. And it was a huge jumpstart for America. And we've got the money to do it again. You know, ignore what the naysayers say, because they just, you know, they're not paying attention to reality. Jim, in Bloomingdale, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, when those high tax rates, they were also sweetened by all kinds of write-offs and deductions for good reason. Now they got their income tax or their tax rate down to 15%, and they still have all those write-offs and deductions.
Yep.
That's why they don't pay any taxes at all.
Yeah, that's
the reason I called was you said that investing in the power grid and infrastructure would create jobs.
Yes.
Well, that's why the Republicans block it.
Of course.
The middle-class jobs, that's the last thing they want.
You're right. You're absolutely right. They do not want a strong middle class because a strong middle class is A, politically active, and B, typically Democratic with a big D. And the Republicans do not want that. The Republicans are the toadies of the rich, the powerful, and the corporate, period. End
of sentence. I got a couple of requests for you.
Say what?
I got a request here.
What's that?
Could you always call it the Reagan-Bush debt? Because they're the ones who ran it up. No one
sure.
ever calls it what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Reagan tripled the national debt, and then George W. Bush and George Bush Sr. pretty much doubled it again. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the Reagan-Bush debt.
Speaking of surveillance here, there was a ruling, a Supreme Court ruling back in the 30s, I believe, where I think it was wiretapping, J. Edgar Hoover wiretapping the mafia or whatever it was, and Justice Brandeis in a dissenting statement said that he could foresee the day where the government or whoever could go through a man's files and his effects without ever having to enter his house.
Right.
And that was one of the more amazing statements I've ever read.
Yeah.
He was a prophet.
If that's the case, he absolutely was. Jim, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Katie in Atascadero, California.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
I
hope you're having a wonderful day.
Hi.
I'm in Central California, and we have two large solar plants going in out here. And one of them was totally union. And the other one was supposed to be a non-union plant. Well, they could not function pulling in non-union workers. They had to allow the electrical union in. And then they had the same problem with the operating engineers, the heavy equipment operators. They had to sign a contract with them because they couldn't pull in enough people to operate the heavy equipment. So I think one of the issues for the Republicans is it would building something like a power grid would give the unions, especially the electrical union, who is probably the strongest in the country right now, another step into the workplace that they wouldn't want to see.
Excellent point. And in fact, I would suggest that nationwide, all of these large construction projects that President Obama, the stimulus, you know, about a third of it was tax breaks, about a third of it was just basically keeping up with stuff. and about a third of it was actually building things. Most of that building things stuff kind of falls into that category of you're going to have to hire union labor to do it. And that's probably one of the big reasons why the Republicans were so hysterical about it and why they made him whittle what originally was going to be a $1 trillion deficit down to about $700 or $800 billion, and then whittle that down to actually only about $400 billion of real stimulus, the rest of it being tax cuts and just kind of taking care of business. I think excellent point, Katie. In fact, Katie,
yeah,
Shano
also,
says,
I think one thing that needs to be brought to light more frequently with people who aren't accustomed to unions or don't understand them,
mm-hmm,
is they're extremely skilled labor.
Yes. Yes. And that's one of the things that unions make happen. I remember the tool and die shop my dad worked at. You would come in, you would join the union in the first year or so, you'd be an apprentice for a while, and you know, it took a long time to become a journeyman tool and die maker, to work your way up in the I forget what's the tool and die union, the machinist union, in the machinist union, and the union actually had standards for knowing when somebody was at what stage, and then the company would pay them, you know, in a way that reflected that. Katie Shano says that you are the winner of our book today, a copy of Screwed. We have copies of Screwed here, don't we? You know, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What You Can Do About It. Is that okay with you, Katie?
Oh, I'd love to have it.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold. We will send you one. Danielle, Katie is on line 10. And so pick up her, she'll pick up your mailing address, Katie, and we'll get it off to you. I will sign it this afternoon. Richard in San Francisco. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am fine. I am great, but I'll get better.
And I knew you were going to say that.
Okay.
So I talked to you before because I listen to you a lot because I think that you, besides having an incredible memory for the things that you've learned, I think that you outline the case pretty well for what's going wrong with this country. So I started a project in San Francisco where you go into a neighborhood and affect change. So I went into our poor neighborhood, and I created $1.3 million for a nonprofit that handles the seniors, the drug addicts, the mentally ill, and alcohol-addicted people.
That's great, Richard.
So,
we only have about a half a minute left. How'd you do it, and what would you suggest others do?
Yeah, that takes a lot more than half a minute. But the point is you go into a neighborhood, affect change, and then send the second team in, and they take the issues and problems the first team found, and they educate the people on how their issues and problems came about. That creates a like-minded group of voters, and that votes these people out of office. And so I got that project going on two coasts and two continents right now. And I'm on your website. I'm trying to post something there to send you some information. I sent you three documents.
Great. You might want to start your own blog over there, too. Is there any other website that you want to point us to, Richard?
Not right now. We didn't put that together yet. But,
okay.
You can create... And it's a lot of the questions that you post that are problems that our country's having.
Yeah. No, it sounds great. You can create your own blog over at tomhartman.com. Just, you know, let us know about it, and people will find it over there. Thank you, Richard. Thanks for the call, and thanks for the good work you're doing. Good on you. That is marvelous. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And finally, the Obama administration has said, Sherman Antitrust Act? You mean there's a Sherman Antitrust Act? Yes, American and U.S. Airways, no. Welcome back. There's a great piece, Masaccio, over at Fire Dog Lake. It's reprinted in part over at Democratic Underground. And basically, two sentences say the whole thing. It's about the bankruptcy of Detroit. And he says, basically, and I'm paraphrasing now, he says, basically, Detroit, we did this story last week. Detroit has Christie's coming in. They're inventorying and appraising the items in the Detroit Institute of Arts. Detroit has had one of the most beautiful art, you know, not one of the most beautiful in the country, but a very, very good one. And back 30, 40 years ago, when Louise and I lived in Detroit, we used to go to the Detroit Art Institute every single Sunday for Sunday services that SRF held there. But we also would then spend the afternoon wandering around the Art Institute looking at their collection. Never did see the whole thing. I mean, it's huge. So they're selling this off to give the money to rich people. Now, why? And here's a simple answer, very simple answer. Because when Detroit needed money, they borrowed it from rich people rather than taxing rich people. And now they can't pay the money back, and so they have to give them all their art.
Duh.
Why didn't that occur to me? I mean, this is such a simple explanation. The city's bankrupt. Why are they bankrupt? Well, because they borrowed money from rich people when they should have taxed them. Out of the mouths of babes, you know? I mean, I have no idea. Masaccio might be, you know, older than me, but still, it's like simple brilliance. Let's put it that way, rather than, you know, some cliche that implies age. Arthur in Davie, Florida. Hey, Arthur, what's up? Shelley Adelson, really?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I want to talk about something that occurred or an item that occurred last year.
Mm-hmm.
In 2012, there were articles in the New York Times and in the Miami Herald about an investigation into Walmart and their violation or possible violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It involved their expansion in Mexico.
Right, I remember. They actually
items by the accusations were by paying off governmental officials when it came to building permits,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
They actually got nailed for that, did they not? I thought it was more than just an investigation. I thought there was an actual prosecution or an out-of-court settlement.
I never saw that. But the other thing that's involved in that was Sheldon Adelson, the multimillionaire or billionaire.
Billionaire, yeah.
And his casinos in, I think I'm pronouncing it correct, in Macau.
Macau, yes. I've been there. It's an island off the coast of China.
Considered in violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And I would love to see him.
He is being investigated for that.
Yes.
He is. And that was, in fact, there was a lot of speculation that one of the reasons why he threw so much money at the Mitt Romney campaign was because he believed that he could pull basically a Jimmy Hoffa. You know, back in 59 when Jimmy Hoffa was being prosecuted by the Eisenhower administration's Justice Department for the Sun Valley land deal, he had taken Teamster pension money illegally and used it to invest in a development down in Florida called Sun Valley Estates or something like that. And, he got busted for it. It's illegal to do that. You can't use the pension fund for that. And so he took $500,000 to the White House in cash and gave it to Richard Nixon, the vice president. And Nixon got the charges dropped. And then as soon as the Kennedy administration came in, one of the very first things that Robert Kennedy, the new attorney general, did was reinstate those charges against Hoffa, which triggered a chain of events that somewhat indirectly led to the assassination of Jack Kennedy. But anyhow, Shelley Adelson apparently thought that he could pull a Jimmy Hoffa, that if he could get his guy in the White House, in this case Mitt Romney, that Mitt would drop the charges or stop the investigation of him. That's what people were speculating. And it sounds like a reasonable speculation. I don't know if what his real motivations were, and I don't think anybody does other than him. But, we'll see how this all plays out. And I'm pretty sure that Walmart actually got nailed on the thing in Mexico, but I'd have to go back and look at the story. Thanks for bringing it up, Arthur. Excellent stuff. Bruce in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Bruce, you wanted to talk about asbestos and Canada?
Like you, I have a shady past in advertising.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Back in the late 60s, early 70s, I was working for a large agency in Canada,
mm-hmm,
and as an account executive, and mm-hmm, one of my accounts was Johns Manville.
Yeah.
And they owned a city in Quebec called, are you sitting down, Asbestos.
You're
that
kidding.
The name of the city. The
wow.
Huge asbestos mine. Anyway, my advertising was industrial, business mm-hmm to business,
uh-huh,
or business to municipalities and governments.
Sure.
One day I was sitting in their office and we were getting together some kind of ideas for an ad campaign for transite pipe,
mm-hmm,
which is this huge pipe that they use underground and under the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, look, some of the other products we mention what's in it, why don't we mention what's in this? And you should have seen his face, the ad manager over there. He started humbling and fidgeting and guffawing and said, well, we don't have to do it in this case.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't tell me why. And he wouldn't tell me what was in it. And it was later we discovered that it was asbestos.
Amazing.
So there you go. I mean, they were purposefully trying to hide the fact that asbestos was in it. This is 19, to the best of my knowledge, it was 1970.
Yeah, it was in the mid-70s that the first, I think, successful lawsuit on behalf of people who had mesothelioma happened. I might be wrong about the year because my dad didn't get this until the 2000s. I think it's 2006 when he was diagnosed. But, And having a past in the ad agency business, I just want to give another tip of the hat to my friend Terry O'Connor, who died on Saturday of mesothelioma. Terry owned an ad agency called Terra Graphics back in the late 60s, early 70s, and in 72 I joined him in that. And I learned, I don't want to say everything I know, but everything of consequence that I know about advertising, about that business, about communications, about how to write, about how to successfully communicate, I learned from Terry. And he was a wonderful and brilliant guy. And he had the account, I've told the story before, about writing that 24-page booklet that went out to millions of school kids called Sugar, the Essential Nutrient, that caused me to leave the advertising business. Well, it caused Terry to, too. That was sort of the end of that business. And that was his account. It was one of the big cereal companies. And he used to do the covers. He actually did the boxes for them and stuff. So I learned a lot from him. Anyway, Bruce, thank you for sharing the story. It's nice to meet another guy, you know, a fellow madman, as it were. Thank you, Bruce. Alex in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I want to talk about the auto industry in Detroit and Democratic leadership. We got Republicans in our local union who talk about the auto industries, the union, it's their own fault for what's going on in Detroit by years of demanding too much from the auto industry that made them leave.
Right.
And then secondly, they argue that Chrysler and Chevy, Chevrolet, General Motors, they produced an inferior product. And what you see around the internet now is this picture of Tokyo, Japan, at 1945, blown up, and Detroit, juxtaposed with Detroit. And then below that, you see modern-day Detroit and Japan, and they're just totally inverted
sure.
in terms of their development.
Yeah, but what changed that wasn't the unions. It was our trade policy.
The post-World War II era. So
yeah.
I think we're kind of interested in what you thought about that.
Well, it's a very simple thing. The auto industry did not leave Detroit because the unions were demanding too much money. The auto industry left Detroit to the extent that it did. Because we changed our trade policies. We did two things. We allowed foreign companies to come into the United States and manufacture cars here in non-union states and sell them domestically in the United States with no tax, basically, on their foreign earnings, us being the foreign part of the earnings. So they just take all the money back to Germany or take it back to Japan or take it back to South Korea, number one. And number two, we dropped basically all the tariffs on imported cars to give them a foothold in our car industry. You did not have foreign cars driving around the streets of the United States prior to the mid-1970s. It was very rare. I mean, every now and then you'd see a Mercedes-Benz or a Rolls-Royce and, you know, or a foreign sports car, an MG or something, and everybody would turn and look because it was just such an amazing thing back in the 70s. And then, you know, of course, Reaganomics came and our trade policies started changing and most favored nation status and all this stuff, permanent normalized trade relations, PNTR, and then, of course, the WTO and NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, and a whole bunch of them. And so the upshot of that is that at that point, to the extent that you can say the auto industry left Detroit, I'd say it just slowly disintegrated in the face of that overwhelming competition. But, yeah, there is cheaper labor overseas, although Japanese auto workers make more than American auto workers do. So for anybody to claim that this has anything to do with what unionized workers in Detroit are making is absolute nonsense if they're using Japan as an example. Japanese auto workers, I don't remember the exact amount. I know that auto workers in Germany make over $45 an hour, and you've got auto workers now in Detroit who are starting at $14 an hour. So You know, this it's got nothing to do with the cost of union labor, because the cost of union labor in Germany and Japan is higher than it is here. Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's all about the rules of the game. You know, that's our trade policy, is the rules of the game. It's like, if you can change the rules of the game of baseball so that only the Yankees get five strikes at bat, hey, they're going to start winning. This is a place where smart people get their news. And speaking of news, let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service at the White House today. Brought to you, by the way, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world today?
Well, Egypt is up in the world today, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
We are hearing that the health ministry is putting up the latest figures at 235 dead, 2,001 injured. The Muslim Brotherhood is claiming over 2,000 dead. So I would say somewhere in between those two numbers lies the truth.
Yeah, this is what happens when a military is running a government. I mean, you would think that they should have known. You don't shoot at civilians. You just don't do it. As soon as you start going down that road, that's a bell that's very hard to unring.
Very hard to unring, indeed. Very hard to unring. And I heard this morning a Muslim Brotherhood spokesman heard this with my own ears as the first camp was being cleared out, stating flat out that more protesters were coming into the area.
Oh, people are going to start supporting the Muslim Brotherhood simply because they see them as the underdogs. This is, you know, it's the same thing that happened in the early days of the Occupy movement when the police started, you know, pepper spraying and heavy-handed stuff, and they got a lot of sympathies. It was when the police started actively sabotaging them instead, you know, by sending, like, you know, homeless people and mentally ill people into the Occupy camps, and there was a whole variety of ways that the police disrupted them that didn't involve direct violence. They were arguably indirect violence, that they were actually able to kind of put an end to it.
Well, he said that these people were coming and that they were Brotherhood supporters and that they were ready to go to the graveyard.
Oh, my.
So, that's the kind of mood. You also had a situation where many regular citizens are just so sick of it, so sick of the disruption to regular life in Cairo, that they were egging on the security forces.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And because they regard the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorists, and the Muslim Brotherhood didn't do anything to disabuse them of that today by storming council buildings and other government buildings and then setting on fire a number of Coptic Christian churches and shops in Upper Egypt.
So now we're seeing the beginning of a civil war. It's the Iraqification of Egypt.
It's really a very, very serious situation.
This is not good at all.
And they've imposed a month-long curfew.
The other not good part about it is, did you catch that document? I think it was NPR did it, where they said, where does the Egyptian foreign aid go? Did you catch that?
I did not.
They tracked the $3 billion annually in foreign aid that goes to Egypt.
Yes.
It all goes to a bank account in Virginia. That bank account then writes checks to companies in Virginia and Washington, D.C., who own companies that make weapons all over the United States. And the weapons get shipped to Egypt. We don't actually send any money to Egypt. We send money to U.S. defense contractors. Had we been sending money to Egypt, and, I mean, we sent a little bit, but by and large, most of it's going through this checking account. Had we actually been sending money to Egypt and saying, use this to build schools, use this to build hospitals, I think things might be very different.
Well, they might be, because I saw in a couple of different news outlets today people who were objecting to the violence, seeing helicopters flying overhead, saying, you know, this is happening with your aid money.
It's true. We put those helicopters there.
It's very disturbing.
Yes.
In other news, the Pentagon plans to extend full personnel benefits to same-sex military and civilian couples by September the 3rd, it said today.
Mm-hmm.
The Defense Department remains committed to ensuring that all men and women who serve in the U.S. military and their families are treated fairly and equally as the law directs. Now, the enrollments in health care coverage and requests for housing benefits or separation allowances are retroactive to the Supreme Court ruling that struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. And for members who are married after June the 26th, entitlements begin at the date of marriage.
For gay members.
Yes, indeed.
That's marvelous.
Yes. Also, for military personnel who live in a state where there is no gay marriage, they are being given leave to travel to a state where there is so that they can get married.
Right. Good news. Good news.
Also, the White House has released a new report arguing that a pathway to citizenship for the nation's 11 million illegal immigrants would add 2 million jobs to the economy and boost gross domestic product by $1.4 trillion over the next decade.
It would. It would. I mean, once somebody is no longer an undocumented worker, they can demand at least the minimum wage, and they can prevent their employers from abusing them, use the force of law to prevent them from being abused, which means that wages are going to go up when wages at the very bottom. And when wages go up at the very bottom, 100% of that money gets spent into the economy, or most of it. Some of it might be being sent back home, but most of it gets spent into the economy, and that stimulates the economy. Surprise, surprise. Anyway.
Interesting economics.
Yes, end of Econ 101. Yeah.
Also, House Democrats are saying they will not serve as a rubber stamp for fiscal deals that the White House negotiates this fall. Representative Chris Van Hollen, who's the ranking member on the House Budget Committee, said this week that when you've got a core group of hard-right Republicans in the House that oppose any kind of negotiated agreement, that obviously means that House Democrats have to be at the negotiating table when they come to negotiate over the debt ceiling.
So is he talking about, Mr. Obama, you may think that chain CPI is a great idea, but don't bring it to us? Is it that kind of thing? Is it that specific, or is it just, you know, more general,
it's
don't
not
compromise?
That specific, but what they're saying is they've got three firm principles that they've given to the White House. No entitlement cuts without tax increases, no boost to defense spending without domestic spending increases, and no paying ransom for a hike to the debt limit.
Marvelous. Marvelous.
Those are their three principles that they say that they're going to be firm on.
Let's hope that they do, that they are. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great to see you, and we'll see you tomorrow. We'll be right back, and when we come back, we're going to have an interesting conversation with Tim Kavanaugh of the Daily Caller.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Okay, back in the first hour of this program, I laid out my argument for why the Postal Service, why we should rewrite the laws regulating the Postal Service and allow them to offer secure encrypted email services. And the argument, I think, boils down very, very simply. When you make a deal with a private corporation, you are signing a contract. And if that corporation doesn't, first of all, that contract is not going to be written between you and that corporation. You're not going to have any say in the writing of the corporation. The corporation and their lawyers write the contract, and they do it in a way that will maximize the profits and benefits to the corporation and screw you, right? I mean, they'll only give you what is absolutely minimally necessary to get you on board, number one. And so, because their goal is not to serve the public, it's to make money. If they make the money serving the public, fine, but, you know, it's to make money. And number two, that on the other hand, when you send mail, first-class mail right now, because of the way the federal law is written, if somebody opens that mail between the time that you put it in the mailbox and the time that the person on the other end gets it, they've committed a federal crime. So there's already a precedent for the post office delivering things with integrity, with Fourth Amendment integrity, unless they have a warrant. They can't open it. So the post office could easily do the same thing electronically. They could give you an electronic envelope. You drop your email into it. It automatically encrypts. It gets sent to somebody on the other end, and they automatically decrypt it. They take it out of the envelope. Nobody opens it along the way. And not only would we not write the contract with a for-profit corporation, we'd be writing the contract through our elected representatives with ourselves and with the one agency in our lives that at the very least is supposed to serve us as its first goal rather than serve profits for big corporations. So that's my argument. Tim Cavanaugh is on the line, executive editor with the Daily Caller, the website dailycaller.com. And Tim, I just presented this, you, me, God, and all our viewers and listeners got to hear it. What do you think?
I think, I'm not really sure what's the news here because, Google has come out and said it, in a way that obviously if you're trying to sell a company to the public, you're not going to be, highlighting this stuff, but said what I can't imagine anybody who's been using Gmail hasn't realized, that when you say certain things in an email, you'll see certain ads come up, and clearly there is some entity of some sort, I don't know whether to call it intelligence or not, that's looking at that and figuring out how can we market to this person. I sympathize in possibly with where you're thinking in terms of the contract, because we all have the terms of service that we have to click on, and who has the time to read it all. And it's really voluminous, and obviously it's all done so that in any coin toss, the coin goes to the company and not to the customer.
Right, and for the record, right. By the way,
that's why you're legally obligated to read it and sign it.
Let's say this is just to take Google out of the equation. You and I are not sitting here bashing Google. The same is true of AOL Mail. The same is true of Hotmail. The same is true of Yahoo Mail. It's
right.
It's true of pretty much any for-profit email provider.
Right. One thing you have to keep in mind is that Google Mail is something you don't pay for. I believe you'll love this. There's mail at ronaldreagan.com. Somebody is using the ronaldreagan.com domain to give you super encrypted email. You pay for the service, and you can then, send and receive all
right.
the email you wish.
But here's the one problem with that, Tim.
On your end, it will remain private.
Right, but here's the one problem with that. And there were two companies that Ed Snowden was using, and they both just committed suicide. Rather than turn their servers over to the FBI, they shut down their companies and they destroyed all their data. And, that's doing the honorable thing. But the fact of the matter is either one of those two companies could just as easily have said, and if they were very large and very profitable, and particularly a public company, they probably would have done it this way, would have said, okay, we're just going to bankrupt that division of our company. And in the bankruptcy process, all the information on those servers becomes an asset of the creditors. It gets sold, and now all your encrypted emails are public knowledge,
right.
or at least can be sold. If it was the Postal Service, that would never happen. And if it was the Postal Service, I mean, right now, if somebody at Gmail reads one of your emails and decides to post it over on the National Enquirer, you're basically, you have a terms of service disagreement. You have a lawsuit against them.
Yeah,
but if it's somebody at the Postal Service, they go to jail.
Miss Manners, Judith Martin, if you remember Miss Manners from way back, she used to have a Q&A or something like that back when they called it cyber politeness or cyber manner.
Right, yes.
And one of her points was you should treat an email, you should expect about as much privacy as you would with a postcard. And you and I are old enough to remember postcards.
Right.
I think that, that's why, this is a much, much, infinitely more convenient service that you're getting for free, as opposed to the Postal Service,
right.
And that you're paying for that with a lower expectation of privacy. And what we're talking about with the FBI seizing stuff, I think the FBI could easily seize anything it wanted from Google, right? Because they can always say, well, you're in business to turn a profit, and therefore we have a bazillion other agencies that can look into everything you're doing and turn over every nook and cranny. And so, that if we're going to talk about security against the government, That's a different issue than I thought. What I thought we were talking about now, which is this Google announcement about who can, you know, what they're doing with
your
email.
Well, I think the Google's announcement has like you, as you pointed out, Tim, has validated for everybody what they always suspected all along, which is that these big corporations might not be treating their information with the delicacy and privacy that they had hoped for. My solution is to, you know, give new life to the post office by saying that they can go into the business of secure encrypted email. What's wrong with that?
I don't know. It hadn't occurred to me. I mean, I don't know. Why are we looking to give new life to the Postal Service?
It's Ben Franklin's invention. It's kind of a cool thing. It's mentioned in the Constitution. And I think
they'll retain their mail, their monopoly on mailed letters for as long as...
Not if Rand Paul has anything to say about it.
What's that?
Not if Rand Paul has anything to say about it. I think there's something to be said.
I find it unlikely that the U.S. Postal Service is going to be completely rolled back at any point. I mean, it'll always exist in some vestigial manner to cover whatever vestiges of the old mail system existed.
No, they'll just do it to the point that they get rid of the unions.
The worst thing you could see is to monopolize email the way you're talking.
No, I'm not talking about monopoly.
Well,
this would be a high end. This would be a premium service.
The Postal Service is a monopoly.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about a monopoly on email. I'm saying allow them to offer a premium service for a fee. I would much rather buy that from a government agency.
Stopping them? I mean, I don't think.
Yes, the law stops them from doing this. They cannot get in the business of doing email right now.
The U.S. Postal Service can't get in the business of doing. I thought they
tried
several times. I remember several efforts from USPS to offer email service, and none of them ever really took off.
Well, Senator Sanders is proposing a piece of legislation that would allow them to, and right now, my understanding is they're blocked by law. But it might be a recent law, but they're blocked by law from expanding the services that they offer. That might be part of this postal reform in 2006 that required them to set aside $5 billion a year.
I have no beef with that. I agree the Postal Service is in the Constitution. You know, the Constitution says establish a Postal Service. It doesn't say maintain one forever. But,
communications is our infrastructure.
USPS wants to offer that as a for-fee service, as other people do. Like I said, I mentioned before, a private email provider who is doing the same thing.
Right, RonaldReady.com.
That competition, great.
Yeah, I'm just saying that I think that communications, mail communication, is part of our infrastructure. It's an infrastructure that businesses use, that individuals use, and it should be an inexpensive part of our infrastructure to help make us more competitive in the world. But anyhow, it's Tim Cavanaugh, executive editor with The Daily Caller, dailycaller.com. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks a lot. Great talking to you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, dailycaller.com. You'll find Tim's writings. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Jim in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Jim, you wanted to disagree that allowing undocumented workers in the United States to become citizens will help the economy. Go ahead,
yeah,
all right.
You made a comment earlier, right, about a quote from, it was a press release from the White House, I think.
As I recall, Victoria was sharing the information. I'm not sure what her source was.
Okay, and what I don't understand about that is that I got some paperwork. I'd like to find out where in history have you seen an anemic economy, which is what we've had for 30 years, can bring in up to 30 million or more than 30 million workers in the next 10 years, and how things are going to get better, how wages are going to go up.
Well, if you're framing it that way, Jim, I would agree with you. But we're not bringing in anybody. Those people are already here. They're already working here. And many, if not most of them, are working for less than $7 an hour. And by giving them some sort of legal status, just a green card, what you do is you take away from their employers the power to tell them, you're going to have to work for $5 an hour, and I'm going to pay you cash so nobody gets any tax money on it. Because if you don't, I will turn you over to ICE.
How can that possibly make any difference when there'll be another illegal alien to take his place if he doesn't work that cheap?
Well, because because if this immigration bill is done right,
illegal aliens from coming in.
If there's a very simple way you stop them from coming in, you make it illegal to hire them.
Yeah, well, we've already done that, and you see how well it worked.
It worked brilliantly up until 1986, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing that law. And from 1986, and up until 1986, you had a million people who came north every year in the spring and a million people who went south every year in the fall. They came up for the picking season, basically. And a few would stay, a few would go. But basically, you know, we did not have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. Reagan stopped enforcing the law against illegal employers. It used to be if you were caught at your meat packing plant or in your construction site with people who were not legal citizens, and typically it was the unions who turned people in. If you were caught with people who were not legal citizens, you, the employer, could go to jail or suffer really huge fines. Reagan changed that.
What's going to change that in the future?
The law that is being proposed, the law that has been proposed explicitly has provisions to criminalize or recriminalize the employment of people who are not citizens.
That's what the last law did.
No, it didn't.
Well, it was enforced.
Well,
it's like that. They always put these. No, look, if you look at the 1986 amnesty, all these things were put in place. Same, very same thing. We're going to end illegal immigration. This is going to put an end to it. We're going to legalize.
I don't believe it, though. That was done by Republicans, and they very much did not want to end illegal immigration because their buddies in industry wanted more cheap labor.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter who did it. They put those things in law, and nobody's been enforcing them since the mid-90s.
That's right.
So it doesn't matter
since the mid-80s.
Put in law. What I'm trying to tell you is that they have on the books ready to come in, doubling the HB1 workers.
Yeah, I know.
Doubling the amount. That's going to put over 160,000 a year.
I know. I'm totally opposed
to
it.
By the way, let me just point something out, too. I don't want to take up too much time, but there used to be, you have to put in a labor condition application to get an HB1 or HB worker visa in.
Yep.
And they used to print those. Those used to be public that you could go on a website. And when you saw who they were bringing in, I mean, the worst case in my county alone was one that said somebody wanted to bring a manager in for a dollar store and he needed an HB1 visa.
Wow.
When you see that kind of abuse.
Yeah.
Happening, and I mean it's going to be full-on scale abuse that this amnesty is going to bring on. You know, this is a really, really bad situation, and you cannot add 30 million people to this economy.
It's not 30, it's 13.
Anywhere but down.
It's not 30, it's somewhere between 10 and 13,
no,
and as I said, they're already here.
No, let me write it down for you. There's 1 million plus that come in every year legally.
Not in the last 3 years. We've actually had net negative immigration from the United States.
No.
People have been leaving
since
2008.
Look and see, there was 900,000, I think, last year came in.
It might have been 900,000 come in. There must have been over 1 million who left because we have had net negative immigration at least between the United States and countries south of the United States. It has been net negative since the crash in 2008.
Well, you have to break that down whether that's illegal or legal. But when you're talking about legal, I'm talking about legal immigration.
Okay, I'm talking about illegal.
Steady 1 million a year.
Okay.
Plus, one year it was.
Well, then we're talking apples and oranges because I'm talking illegal. Jim, I understand your point. I agree with you that when you dilute the labor pool, you drive wages down, and it's not a good thing. And I agree that we need to be putting employers in jail. And that's where, you know, maybe I'm naive, and I hope I'm not, that, you know, in my belief that if an immigration law is passed, this issue has become high profile enough and enough of the middle class is sufficiently engaged and enraged about these kind of things, about the death of the middle class, and increasingly they're being told to blame it on brown people from South America, that there actually will be some enforcement of the law. But, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see what happens. And I agree with you that the current bill that it radically expands all these visas is an abomination, and at least that part of it is. And on the other hand, you got between 10 and 13 million people who are here, and they came here because somebody here offered them a job, and we're not doing anything to those people who offered them a job. Instead, we're trying to go after the people who showed up just trying to make their lives better. And that seems to me like it's just fundamentally unfair and wrong. We should be, if we're going to be throwing anybody in jail or deporting anybody, it should be the people who said, hey, come on over, I got a job for you. So, Jim, thank you for the call. We're not going to resolve this immigration issue in 30 seconds here on the air, or 3 minutes here on the air even. And it's a big issue. And frankly, I will be astounded if anything is done on this at all between now and 2016, because the Republicans are in such disarray and they control the House of Representatives. But we'll see.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and did I mention that the Obama administration discovered that there was this thing called the Sherman Antitrust Act and they could apply it to airlines? The bad and the very, very mullerously ugly. The good. Rosanelle Eaton, the 92-year-old North Carolina grandmother, old enough to have experienced the worst of the Jim Crow era discrimination, is suing her home state to block its new voter suppression laws, the most restrictive ones in the country. On Tuesday, the NAACP filed a complaint on behalf of Eaton in the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of North Carolina. The lawsuit claims that North Carolina's new voter ID requirements are overly burdensome and as a result violate Eaton's basic constitutional rights. With Republicans as committed to suppressing the vote as they are, the fight to preserve the franchise will be a tough one. But brave people like Rosanelle Eaton should give all of us hope that not everyone has forgotten the value of democracy. The bad. Congressman Louie Gohmert. During a Monday appearance on the Steve Malzberg Show, the Texas congressman claimed that the Obama administration is stirring up racial tension. Seriously, check it out.
We know that this president, this administration has done more to stir up racial tension and violence than any administration since, the 60s.
Incredible. Congressman Gohmert is really the last person who should be talking about stirring up racial tension. Just listen to what he said about the Obama administration and the Muslim Brotherhood back in April.
Because radical Islam is at war with us. Thank God for the moderates that don't approve of what's being done. But this administration has so many Muslim Brotherhood members that have influence that they just are making wrong decisions for America.
And the very, very ugly Bill O'Reilly. On Tuesday night's episode of The Factor, the Fox News host mocked California's new transgender rights bill as a con for teenage boys who just want to hit on their female classmates. Seriously, check this out.
If you go in and say, listen, I feel that even though I am down as a boy in school, yeah, I want to be with the girls. I want to play in the
I
girls.
Did that senior in high school.
Right, but this is the problem. You're hitting on it. Because they can't.
I like being the girl. See, this is the biggest con in the world. I would have been on every... If I come back and I'm reincarnated and I'm a teenager, bang, right there.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is that Bill just doesn't understand how hard it is to be transgendered in America, especially when you're a teenager trying to deal with every other high school problem. Sometimes the waiting period for expensive gender reassignment surgery can be years. In the meantime, the best we can do as a society is make sure that transgendered students can live their lives as they want and without harassment. That Bill O'Reilly can so callously laugh off the difficulties of being transgendered in America by suggesting that a boy who wants to use a girl's locker room just wants to hit on the girls, it's not only wildly inaccurate, it's very, very ugly. It's one of the most bigoted things I've... bigoted is not even the right word. He has no clue. I mean, to say something like that, he must literally have never known a transgendered person in his life. He has no clue. Either that, or he's just a total crazy. Sherman? Oh, yeah. Twice I've mentioned the U.S. Justice Department has discovered that there is a Sherman Antitrust Act And they've said, we let United merge with Continental. I don't know if that thing was put forward during the Bush administration or not. I don't remember exactly what year it was proposed. Typically, it takes a year or two for those things to play themselves out. I think it might have been the last year of the Bush administration. But in any case, when U.S. Air and American Airlines said, okay, let's form the largest airline in the world, the Obama administration said, not so fast. Wow. I'm impressed. We'll see how this goes. You know, as they say, watch this spot. Jeff in Statesville, North Carolina. Jeff, what's on your mind? You want to talk about health exchanges in your state, in North Carolina?
Yes, sir, I do. And I'm a huge fan. 3 hours a day is like the best. You're the best teacher I've ever had. So
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And so a couple weeks ago, North Carolina state legislature quietly did something. I don't really know how normal this is, you know, to happen, but they made the rates and the packages of all the exchanges for the healthcare exchange that they made them trade secrets.
Really?
I just, you know, because I've always seen that was going to be, that was a glaring loophole, kind of big problem with Obamacare, was that they let the states be in charge of the healthcare exchanges, and then they had the mandatory deal. And so I was like, well, okay, that's going to put poor people in a really rough position. And I was just curious the other day about how it went, but it happened 2 weeks ago. And so nobody can find out what's going on until the last second, and that's going to make it so that, you know, no competition is going to happen. And this is going to be a big, I just predict this is going to be a big fight, you know, this is a problem.
At least for the first year. Yeah. Until the 2016 election. That's what they're going to do. They're going to drag it out to 2016. Jeff, I didn't know that. Thanks for the heads up on that. I'm going to have to do a little digging. I can't offer an intelligent comment other than wow. And a horrified wow at that. But let me learn a little bit more about this and get back with you. But that's incredible. I'm not surprised, but that's incredible. Jeff, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. Kirk, listening on KBCS in Bothell, Washington. Hey, Kirk, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for sharing our beautiful, fresh, and free air.
Thank you.
The slaughter of humanity in Egypt today reminded me of an idea I had a couple months ago when Libya was front and center. And basically what I'm thinking is that it seems like the global Muslim community needs to make a very difficult, challenging decision on whether they want to be an 8th century entity, which continually relitigates the Sunni-Shia split that's exploited by multinational defense corporations or nefarious governments for global domination, or whether, they want to embrace a 21st century democratic model. I would say that Central and South America is on a path towards obtaining now.
Yeah, I think so.
What do you think?
I think that you're right, and I think that I had Asa Reslan on the on the television show last weekend or last Friday for a half hour long conversation. And, in fact, if I haven't put it up on Conversations of the Great Minds, I'll check when I get off the air, but it should be over at conversationsofthegreatminds.com. And he suggested that, and he wrote about this in his book, No God But One God, or whatever the title was, something very similar to that. It was his book about Islam. He's got a new book out about Jesus called Zealot. But, you know, he suggested that Islam is right now going through the same kind of reformation process that Christianity went through in the, what were the centuries of the Lutheran revolt and Henry VIII. I guess that'd be what, the 15th, 16th centuries, something like that. And, those kinds of changes now are happening within Islam, and you know, the religions just have to go through this, and the more recent religions, in fact, are you know, I mean, even Mormonism is having some troubles right now. They're all having to kind of adapt to the modern era. So I wouldn't disagree with your analysis, Kirk, at all. I think that debate, I know that that debate is going on within the Muslim community. And let's all hope that the more progressive and modernistic voices, you know, and voices who are the, you know, those who say Islam is a religion of peace and are the ones that prevail. Kirk, thanks for the call. Excellent, excellent issue to bring up. John in Putney, Vermont. Hey, John, what's on your mind tonight?
Hey, today? Tom, how you doing?
It's great.
Hey, have you heard of this new public? It's like in comic book form called Addicted to War. Written by it's a book in comic book form, and it's it starts with World War One and goes right up to today.
Is this come out about 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, I don't know. Somebody just sent it to me recently, and it probably did. It's been out for a while, I guess. Joel Andreas, A N D R E A S.
Yeah, I've seen it. I saw it when it came out. Have it in front
phenomenal.
Of me.
Phenomenal. It I mean, it's like you read it, the more you read, the kind of angrier you get.
Yeah, it basically tells the story of the rise of the military-industrial complex and the takeover of our government and our democracy by said complex.
Another quick thing, what I actually called about was I heard Chris Hedges speak the other day on TV on this station, and also Bill McKibben shortly after, got a double dose of the climate change issue because Chris brought it up and Bill McKibben, and Bill looked kind of frustrated and tired, actually, you know, because he's been all over the world kind of. But there's nothing in my mind, and I've felt this way for a long time, that even comes close to the crisis of global warming. And we
I agree.
As a country need to be the leader in this, and we haven't figured out how to do it.
I absolutely agree. And, John, you know, watch this spot. In about a month, we're going to be talking about that a lot. We've got some stuff coming out. So I don't want to get into it all right now, but just hang out with us for a few more weeks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, not only is global warming the issue of our time, it could be the issue of the end of our time. Okay. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and Jay in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind? You want to talk about immigration?
Yeah, you know, I heard you touch on that. I guess I've theorized about it. You and I have talked before about this culmination of events, globalization, one world order, RFID chip. You probably remember me. I've called that a few times.
Sure.
And, you know, I can't help. I want your take on this. And I don't think, you know, use a little deductive rationale. Let's add a few things together. Keystone Pipeline seemed pretty predictable to me. The makings of the connection of Canada to the U.S.
Right. It's a Canadian company.
The BMO-Harris merger that took place not too long ago. Inklings of a North American Union. I take immigration as, I mean, it seems obvious to me, like in Chicago and Illinois here, they issue driver's licenses to illegal immigrants. So when I saw that, here's what I thought. Well, you know, they're just consumers. They're going to be part of a North American Union. Why not give them IDs now? Your thoughts on that's what's really going on here?
Well, I think that if Rand Paul and the other libertarians and the libertarian Republicans and the, you know, and some of the more corporatist Democrats had their way, that we may be looking at a, you know, United States of North America. And by United States, it would include everything from Saskatchewan to Oaxaca or whatever the name of that state is down there in southern Mexico. And, you know, that NAFTA would become the organizing principle of North America rather than the U.S. Constitution. I would be very, very strongly opposed to that, and increasingly economically that's what's happened, but politically not so much. I can see where you could build a very, very strong case for a conspiracy theory that we are moving in that direction, and I wouldn't ridicule it or discount it. On the other hand, I think that there's a lot of Americans who are genuinely horrified by such an idea, and, you know, that's gonna prevent it. But we'll see. Jay, we're just going to have to, you know, have this conversation every 6 months or so, see how we're going and what direction we're going. Thanks for the call. Nate in Bay City, Texas. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I just wanted to add some comments. I was listening just a few minutes ago, and I heard one of your callers discussing Egypt, I believe.
Yeah.
And he was saying that the Muslims need to decide if they want to be modern or if they want to be stuck in an 8th century mentality.
Yeah, it is a bit of an overgeneralization to say the Muslims.
It is 1.5 billion people spread across several different continents. And they're not stuck in the 8th century. These are people who are living in the modern world. They're not, they don't, you know, you can't say that Muslims are this or that. But I would say that they're human beings. They're not angels. They're not devils.
But here's the point, Nate. You will not find, you know, in 17th century America, in the 1600s in the United States, in the state of Massachusetts, you had women being thrown into ponds to see if they would float or sink to determine whether they were witches. You had women being hanged because they were witches. It so offended Ben Franklin when he was 17 years old that he left the state. You had a state government that had been taken over by the Puritans, by a fundamentalist Christian sect that was openly persecuting women and that bore a lot of other resemblances and that was, you know, using capital punishment for people that was, you know, in many ways resembled modern Saudi Arabia in terms of the integration of law and religion. It was rejected by the American people. I don't think that there's any place on earth today where that kind of Christianity is still practiced. And that was the tail end of the Reformation. It looks to me like Islam is at the earlier stages of a similar Reformation, where that kind of Islam is, you know, it's getting a lot of publicity, but it is being rejected increasingly across the world by Muslims. Am I making sense, Nate?
But I mean, this is not something new. You know, there have always been different strains within Islam. You know, for centuries upon centuries, there have been pacifists. There have been people who...
Oh, the Sufis. But the Sufis are persecuted in Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia is a U.S.-supported dictatorship.
I don't disagree.
To me, necessarily about Islam alone. I mean, religions usually are justifications for power, you know, and when you want to seize absolute power.
Well, are you suggesting that Islam is not going through a reformation right now?
All religions are constantly going through reformations.
Okay.
It's a constant process.
You're absolutely right.
And, you know, so... There is this thing that we do in the West, you know, we like to talk about how we're more democratic, but we don't promote democracy in the Middle East. We support dictatorship.
No, you're absolutely right.
And then we blame it
on my point was that one of the leading scholars in the world on the topic of Islam, who himself is a Muslim, Reza Aslan, was telling me on my program about how in his book he wrote that much of modern Islam is in the midst of a transformation that is comparable to the mid last millennia transformation that Christianity went through, and it continues to make sense to me.
I don't doubt that's true. I'm sure it's true.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. But, Nate, I want to move along, but thank you for the call. Your point is well taken. Fletcher in Bristol, New Hampshire. We just have a minute to the end of the show. Fletcher, it's yours. Fletcher? No Fletcher. And we had a couple of other calls, and as soon as I said we just have a minute left and it's yours, they both dropped. Okay. Well, in that case, I will, you know, I just want to add to this that I think that if we want modern day Islam around the world to go through a reformation and come out the other end more modern and more egalitarian, that instead of sending $3 billion worth of military hardware to countries like Egypt, we should be sending $3 billion worth of schools, prefabricated schools, teachers, textbooks, hospitals, healthcare equipment, the mechanism for governance, manuals on democracy, basic fundamental stuff. That's what we should be doing. Don't mess in the religion and stop messing in the military. Coming up tomorrow, latest news and information. What is the right wing up to now? Why are they trying to abolish the renewable fuel standard, of course? We'll find out what's up with that. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, geeky science. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Tag your it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.